And if we form a quorum, we will at the end adopt the minutes and yeah. Over to you, Rich.
Morning, Honorable Chairman, Honorable Members, and thank you for this opportunity. I think the training session is long overdue. I remember the chair requested the training about 18 months or 2 years ago, so finally we get to it. And I also believe that it comes at the right time because we have just completed the audits of the department and the entities. So when we brief the committee on the outcome of the labor portfolio, once the report has been tabled, it will be fresh in your minds in terms of how to interpret the audit report that would have been tabled with the annual report of the department. Chair, if I can take this opportunity to introduce next to me Joshua Bakanzi. He is the senior manager responsible for the DOL portfolio, taking over. I'm sure the committee members remember Daisy Ndwaba. Joshua has replaced Joshua, sorry, Daisy, and was responsible for the DOL portfolio for the audit of the 2012-13 financial year. So Joshua will then be presenting the material, and as I have indicated, the material is meant to empower the committee members to interpret the audit report of the Auditor General and hopefully to ask the right questions when reading this audit report that comes from the Auditor General. What we will be doing, we will be presenting how we audit the financials of departments and entities. And as you would know, we audit three areas. We audit the financials, we audit predetermined objectives, and we audit compliance with rules and regulations. With regard to financials, we express an audit opinion in the audit report. So when you read our audit report, you will find that there are different opinions, and Joshua will go through these different opinions relating to the financials. And when it comes to audit of predetermined objectives, we report factual findings, and Joshua will also go through this. However, we do express an opinion in the management report, which is addressed to management, and it's not a public document. So what you will see is the findings that are in the audit report. And effectively what it means is, if there are findings in the audit report, it means the entity or the department did not have an unqualified opinion on predetermined objectives. If the opinion in the management report is unqualified, you will not see findings in the audit report of an entity or a department. There might have been findings which are not significant. However, they would not be material enough for them for us to give a qualified opinion or adverse opinion or disclaimer of opinion. And then on compliance with rules and regulations, we report on significant findings that are material in nature. And again, Joshua will go through this, illustrating which findings will find themselves in the audit report and which non-compliance findings will not find themselves in the audit report, but in the management report that goes to management only. And with that, Chair, may I hand over to Joshua to take up the presentation.
I prepared a presentation on my computer, but technology is failing us, so we always have, as well as a backup plan. So we'll go with the presentation, the hard copy one. So I'll take you through the presentation, the hard copy, and I'll use a practical example of our audit reports. In the fact that you've been given the two samples of audit reports, one shows Board 18. Mainly, I'll be dealing with Board Number 18, Department of Labor, to illustrate the structure of our audit report. So as I go through the main PowerPoint presentation, I might as well refer to the practical example so that the members follow the different kinds of opinions. And then thereafter, I'll pause for questions and discuss any other queries that the members might be having. So I'm using a PowerPoint presentation first. On page 2 is basically our reputation promise that the Auditor General of South Africa has a constitutional mandate, and as the Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa is expected to strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector through auditing, thereby building public confidence. So basically that's the mission statement and reputation promise that drives what we do as an office and in our day-to-day activities. Chair, on the next page 3 is the agenda of the summary of the presentation. That's the executive summary. I think Macy has already gone through what we're going to be looking at. And then we'll look at the legislative requirements, what gives us the power to audit, then the focus areas that we look at, and then the different, then part 4 is the audit opinion. That's where I'll elaborate further what kind of audit opinions we express as an office or as auditors, and then explain what the emphasis of matter is, and I'll spend some time on predetermined objectives because it's become so topical in our day-to-day activities, and I suppose members as well would want to know what do we do when we look at predetermined objectives. So I'll look at that. I'll also look at compliance, like Mr. explained, but I'll just go through the focus areas that we actually zone in or the ones that we focus on, and then internal controls and other reports that we include in our audit report. Okay, I've already explained the objective summary. Basically, start to discuss the audit report structure and discuss what audit opinion means and the significant findings that include in our report. If we move over to page 5, so if I'm going fast, then yeah, you can stop me. I just highlighted the legislative requirements, and I'll soon go back to the audit report as well. The reason why I've done this is to explain management or the department's or accounting office's responsibility with regards to financial statements and the responsibility of the Auditor General with regards to auditing of those financial statements that are presented by the accounting officer. But mainly so, we derive our mandate from the Constitution. If you look at point 2 here, section 188, that says that we must audit and report on accounts, financial statements, and financial management or government institutions. Still, the Public Act No. 25 of 2004, Section 20, it requires Auditor General to prepare an audit report containing an opinion or conclusion on the three areas. So, we not only prepare an opinion on the financial statements that have been provided, but the Public Audit Act also requires us to conclude on compliance with particular legislation for that particular entity. It also requires us to conclude or report on predetermined objectives. So ideally, when you look at our audit report, we're looking at three areas. The first one is the financial statement, the one that the department gives us to audit. But coupled with that, we also look at compliance with the enabling legislation for that department that PFMA has. So we assess compliance with different legislation for that particular entity or department. We also look at and conclude on predetermined objectives. So I think the basis of my discussion will be focused on those three areas. Okay. Page 6. So what make up the audit report? The audit report, basically the main one is the opinion paragraph. We also highlight some important matters that might be useful to the users of the report as well as the financial statement. So there we highlight either disclosed by the department or the entity or the ones that we pick up as auditors. But I'll further talk to that when I go through the emphasis of matter, trying to explain what an emphasis of matter is and what additional matter is. So like as explained previously, we look at pre-termed objectives, we look at compliance matters, and we look at internal controls and other investigations. Maybe perhaps I would rather pause here and maybe try to give a practical explanation of what I'm talking about. If you take the audit report, the one that has got report of the Auditor General to Parliament on Board 18, it was part of the presentation. It's a does everyone have got that? Yeah. Mm. There's two of them, but there's one which has got Board 18. Included inside the presentation. Yeah, that's it. Mm. I just printed up these. It's not necessarily the one that was tabled. It's the one, but it's a draft one. I cannot be exactly as the one that was tabled in. Yeah, it's one that first March 2012. So I just printed out for illustrative purpose for this session. So as I explained earlier on, is the first page is just the introductory paragraph that says what period we're looking at. The second paragraph two talks about the responsibility of who's responsible for preparing financial statements. And in the case of the Department of Labor, it's management or the accounting office that is responsible for that. Then paragraph 3-5 just talks about the responsibility of the Auditor General as required by the Public Audit Act of 2004, particularly section 20, as well as to say that our audit is done in terms of the international auditing standards. Then I just talked about that what we look at, the opinion paragraph. The opinion paragraph, I think that's what most people look at to say what kind of opinion the Auditor General gave out. That I think for most people, that's the opinion on paragraph 6. That's the opinion. But for us, because we've got extra mandate to report on compliance, we don't only stop at this opinion on financial statements. We still have to report on other legal and regulatory requirements. That's the one I talked about, reporting on compliance and predetermined objectives. So the three areas that we report on is paragraph 6, where we express an opinion. I'll elaborate further on this, what the meaning of that opinion is. And then we also need to report on predetermined objectives, which is paragraph 10. And we report on compliance with laws and regulations from paragraph 21. So basically those are the three areas. So paragraph 6, we're expressing an opinion on the financial statements that the accounting office has provided to us. Paragraph 10, we are providing conclusion on the material findings that we came across during the audit of pre-termed objective. And paragraph 21, we're reporting on material non-compliance with laws and legislation. Okay. I'm going back to the main presentation. Page 7. Here I'll start off, because in paragraph 6, for example, here this is when I'm going to look at the different opinions that we can express. I'm going back to my PowerPoint presentation. There are basically four audit opinions when we audit the financial statement. There are four categories of opinions that we can express as auditors. The first one is it's called the unqualified auditor opinion. If you look on page 7, it's the one that's showing a green. And then the second one is a qualified opinion, it's yellow, not so nice as well. There's also a disclaimer, and lastly, there's an adverse opinion. I'll just go touch one by one briefly. If we move over to the next page, there is detailed explanation of what we mean by unqualified, qualified, disclaimer, and adverse opinion on page 8. Oh, sorry. You don't have that.
And there is this laptop. This laptop is in Hong Kong.
No.
And it's not talking to ours.
How is that?
You're not connecting to the laptop. it's in Hong Kong.
Can I put this here? Okay. On page 8, I'm just explaining the different opinions that we express. Unqualified, or sometimes we call it unmodified, but the main name is unqualified. Here we're saying the time that when we express this opinion is we're saying the financial statements reflect a true picture of the state of affairs of that particular entity or department, that we did not identify in material misstatements, that everything is fairly stated, meaning that for those particular financials, everything is fine. That's when we give unqualified opinion. Then, there is also what we call unqualified with an emphasis of matter. Maybe but an emphasis of matter, we just include it in our report to highlight something that has already been disclosed in the financial statement. It has not changed the opinion that we've expressed. It's not something wrong that we say. We just like to say, we bring it to the attention of the user and say, management has highlighted certain issues in their financial statements. Perhaps the users of financial statements can look at these, but we're not saying we're qualifying or we're giving them a word of opinion. Then the qualified one is, or a qualification basically is, we express this kind of opinion when there is a disagreement with management on a particular application of an accounting standard, and that disagreement is affecting a particular account. It could be, say for example, where we find that they disclosed that they bought assets worth of 10 million, but when we verified, we found that assets that existed at that point in time were worth 5 million. So then we say, no, we disagree with you because you're saying you got assets worth of 10 million, but for us, when you verified the existence of those particular assets, we came up with 5 million. If they correct, then it's fine. If they don't correct and they say they still maintain that they have 10 million worth of assets, yet on our verification we only found 5 million, then we'll qualify them on that particular account of assets. But a qualification is an opinion. Sometimes we call it except for. We're saying these particular financial statements are fairly presented except for this particular account. So that's what we mean by a qualification. The disagreement on application of a particular accounting standard or principle with management only affects a certain account or transaction within the financial statement. It does not affect the entire set of financial statement accounts. It would be just the asset or an expenditure or income account. So the misstatement is not, it's not across the financial statement all over. And then I move over to the next page, or the next opinion is the disclaimer. Disclaimer is basically, in a nutshell, we're saying we as auditors will not expressing an opinion in the financial statement, and purely because we can't be able to do enough work to express an opinion. There is no information for us to work on so that we can express an opinion. So that's why we say it's a disclaimer, and we say it's a disclaimer purely because there's a limitation in scope, or there's a limitation in what we do. There is no information for us to work on so that we can express an opinion on a particular set of financial statements. And this particular limitation is affecting all accounts within the financial statements. But if the limitation is affecting one account, one particular account, then it will be a qualification. But if this limitation or this limitation that cannot allow us to obtain sufficient evidence, then if it affects majority of the accounts within the financial statement, then that's when we say it's a disclaimer. And then I think this is perhaps the worst opinion that anyone can ever get. The first one is more like the qualification, but here we disagree with management on application of a particular standard on a number of accounts. They're saying, okay, we're saying you've misstated assets. They say, no, we haven't misstated assets. Then we go, you've misstated expenditure. You haven't accounted for all expenditures you suppose in terms of particular accounting standard or in terms of a legislation. You haven't accounted for revenue appropriately. So here, it's a disagreement in application of a particular financial reporting framework that affects a number of accounts. So that's when we come up with an adverse opinion. So the difference between an adverse and a disclaimer is, a disclaimer, we can't express an opinion at all. We're limited for us to be able to express an opinion. While an adverse opinion is, we're not limited. The information is there, but whatever they've provided us does not support what they've asserted in the financial statement. Any questions? That's far.
Honorable Funders, is there any others who have got questions?
Okay. Thank you. Chairperson, may I just ask, my impression is that this part of the AG's work is mostly limited to the financials and the figures, which means that if you have got a good bookkeeping system, you keep track of every asset, and you keep track of every expenditure, etc., that the AG will be happy in the sense that they will say, well, we will probably give you, in this case, an unqualified audit, because we have been able to say that you can account for everything and the figures accurately reflect what is it. I have heard that sometimes people say, well, we've had, you know, opinions by the AG, and people speak in the term which you haven't used today, and that is they speak of clean audits, which I would love you just to expand on that as well. They say, for example, the HR division let the finance people down in the sense that they did not keep good records of leave, okay. Which in my mind I would say, well, why would the AG be interested in leave? Well, leave may be a liability towards, you know, those people, and every year we may be owing them 1 million rand in terms of accrued leave or something like that. If you could just tell me, to what extent do you then go and audit, I always want to say, staff or HR files, records, etc. as well? And if you could just perhaps expand on the term clean audit as well, please.
Thank you, member. Hello, member. I think I'll first go, before I go back, I start answering clean audit, I'll just go back to the opening remarks by Maisie when she talked about our audit opinion about three kind of conclusions. We look at the financial statement, we look at compliance with laws and regulations, and we look at predetermined objectives. And for us to say it's a clean audit, all these three areas need to be clean. You don't need to have, when it comes to financial statements, you've received unqualified. When it comes to laws and regulations, you don't have any non-compliance at all. When you come to predetermined objectives, there's no material finding in this particular area. But I'll expand on the other two, because for this opinion ones, I was still looking at the part of the financial statement, part of it. So for you to have a clean, and maybe that's where the honorable members as well, when you're interrogating the audit report, you need to interrogate it based on those three reporting areas. You interrogate it based on the financial aspect, that you prepare the financial statement in terms of required accounting framework, but you also have to interrogate them on the opinion, specifically saying, but how come you've got lots of material non-compliances? And you got a clean bill of health or clean unqualified opinion. You also need to interrogate on predetermined objectives. Like you rightly say, that if you've got a good accounting person who, you say, every expense that he has, he funds the expenditure. He can show you exactly how that expenditure was incurred and how the invoice system and the everything kept, proper accounting records kept. That's fine. But you see, in the course of our work, we go and audit compliance. We don't just restrict our audit to just the financial part of it. We go and audit compliance with the public service regulations, FMA in the more detail. We look at revenue management, expenditure management. We look at asset management. We look at effectiveness of internal audit, and if they're not effective, then how are they helping management to come up with a clean bill of health or a clean administration? We also look at procurement and contract management, because in financial statements you can see that that's the specific focus area that we zone in. We also look at human resource management across all entities and public entities to say that in terms of public service regulation, before you appoint someone, you need to do security checks. Did you do that? In terms of public service regulation, you need to do performance management. Did you do performance management? You're supposed to do disciplinary hearing or investigation if there's anything, and you need to do it within 30 days before. You don't need to prolong the disciplinary process. So all those aspects we look at as part of our compliance testing.
To look at value for money sometimes. We've used this much money. How much did we gain? Was it worth it? Did it really, are we getting value for all?
In a way, our procedures, we incorporate value for money, and we, for particular areas, as part of our testing for compliance, specifically on fruitless and wasteful expenditure. So we go and follow money to say, we design procedure to say that was this particular expenditure necessary, or did you incur it within the required mandate? So we look at it, although it might not be so much detail, but we go procedures to address some certain value for money. Because why we don't look at it in more detail, because some of the issues that where they spend money, we can't be able, because we're not specialists in those fields, we don't have capabilities to go and say, this was actually value for money, but that we incorporating it in our own procedure as we go on. I think.
If I may just add to and starting with your question, value for money, and we'll see it later when we talk about the difference between performance audit and audit of performance information. Ideally, the value for money audit procedures are performed extensively through the performance audit, which looks at whether the goods were procured and used economically, efficiently and effectively. So that's where we will look into the value for money procedures extensively. When we conduct a regularity audit, which is what we are doing currently, because you remember that in the Auditor General we have three areas. We have the regularity audit, where we audit the financials, performance information, and compliance with rules and regulations, auditing the annual report of the department. That is a regularity audit. That's what we are doing. So when we come across something that we feel probably not value for money and could be fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we are required to prove beyond doubt that it is indeed fruitless and wasteful. And in most cases, let me give an example. If an entity or a department required some research to be done so that they can then implement something, that research is done, but it's not used, the report is not used. When you say to the department, but you haven't used the document, you could argue and say, no, but we need funds for us to be implement what the report has suggested. So once the funds are approved, only then can we implement. So it will be difficult to say to the department, this is fruitless and wasteful, but we can just caution in the management report, as I have indicated. Unless another research is conducted and we can prove that the new research done is exactly the duplicate of the previous one, only then can we declare fruitless and wasteful. So we do perform value for money procedures in our audit, but we become very limited at that point as well. Because to prove the three E's, economy, effectiveness, and efficiency, you need a full-blown performance audit. Now coming to the question of audit of leave, when we audit leave, as Joshua has said, it has a financial aspect and a compliance aspect. So whenever we audit, during our regularity audit, we look at the impact that particular finding that we raise has on these three aspects: financial, performance information, and compliance with rules and regulations. Because you might find that while we raise a financial finding, it could be that it had an impact on performance as well. The department might not have been able to achieve because of this finding that we have raised. And while we have raised this financial finding, it could be the department did not follow regulations, and then you end up with an irregular expenditure for argument's sake. So we look at these three areas. And rightfully so, the system of internal controls, and we'll talk about this later when we look at the pyramid of accountability at the end, I'll talk to it. The systems of internal controls are very, very critical in making sure that departments and entities produce reliable, complete, and credible information. And when we talk reliable, complete, and credible information, we talk about these three areas again: the finances, performance report on performance, on performance information, and compliance with rules and regulations. These information reported should be complete, accurate, and credible. In that, there must be a unit that monitors compliance with rules and regulations. So if there are any instances of non-compliance with rules and regulations, the department or entity system should be able to identify them. If there are any issues on performance information, the department or entity's internal control system should be able to identify them. The same applies to financial information. Because what we are saying is when we audit, and we identify material misstatements to the financial information or performance information, it results in non-compliance because the PMA requires entities and departments to keep a complete and accurate record of financial and performance information. So, normally what we, if we report material adjustments to financial information, it means that during the audit, the auditor identified material misstatements in the financial statements and performance information that was submitted for audit. And when we audit again, we zoom into what is the root cause for these misstatements. Any finding that we raise, we link it to a root cause. Let me give you an example again. If we have this material adjustment on the financial statement, what is the root cause? Joshua spoke about an adverse opinion where an entity might not have complied with the accounting standards. And we evaluate whether it's an internal control issue or is it a technical matter issue, which means it would be a once-off. If the internal controls are quite effective and strong, but you have this material misstatement, you'd find that it was a misinterpretation of the accounting standards. So we will not raise it as a material, as a non-compliance issue, as a material adjustment to the financial statement. So we grant the entities and the departments that benefit when we report on non-compliance with rules and regulations. And again, as is indicated, HR is part of the legislated area. So we will look at leave because it's legislated, and if leave is not monitored, it has an impact on the financial statements because then we don't have a proper record of who is owed how much leave at the end of the year. So which means anybody can go on leave as and when they want to, and as a result, the business of the department or the entity suffers because leave records are not kept properly. So it is a big risk in the public sector, and therefore it is of interest to the auditor as well.
Question from the members.
On page 10 of the presentation, basically an index of what makes up our audit report, and I think we've touched on most of the things. I'll just touch on emphasis of matter. How we're saying it's not a qualification, or we're not saying something bad or something terrible. We're just trying to highlight something that has already been disclosed in the financial statement. And then in other reports, we also include additional matters paragraph. That one is we're highlighting something that we think is fundamental to the understanding of the financial statements of the user, but management has not disclosed it in the financial statement. And perhaps maybe for the benefit of the members, there's basically like five or four things that we highlight on the financial statement. One is if there is, for emphasis of matter, if there is a significant uncertainty. Significant uncertainty we mean something like agricultural entities facing material litigation. They don't know the outcome of that particular litigation. It's dependent on what the court is going to come up with. So, and that litigation might be so huge that it's going to affect the particular entity might be required to pay out lots and lots of millions, and they might not be having money to pay out. So we try to highlight that as emphasis of matter, but management first needs to have disclosed in the financial statement. The other thing that we normally highlight for emphasis of matter is underspending on the board, and perhaps for the benefit of members, that one you can question. If the department comes with the audit report and is an emphasis of matter, then you need to ask them, why did you underspend? So that we highlight. They disclose it. If they don't use the particular vote, then highlight that one there. That one is a going concern. It's not applicable to the department specifically, but more to the smaller entities. And the other issue that we normally I highlight or emphasize on in the emphasis of matter is when last year's figures have been restated. So because the users of financial statements use different figures in the prior year, but in the current year, entity has restated the financial statements. So basically, those are the main issues that we normally emphasize on, or emphasis of matter. Okay, as we explained earlier on, report on legal and regulatory requirements, the strict time objective and compliance with laws and regulations. Messi touched on internal controls. In our report, we also highlight on why we report on internal controls. We highlight those internal controls that led to qualification or that led to findings in compliance and laws and regulations, or that led to findings in determined objectives. So for members' interest, especially for that internal control, when you're analyzing our report, you need to find out why the question you should be asking, I think, for you is why did you allow non-compliance to occur, or why did you allow findings on predetermined objectives. So the internal controls will give you the three fundamentals under leadership, financial performance management, and governance that lead to those findings in compliance, or if there's a qualification or adverse or disclaimer. So we highlight those deficiencies that lead to those particular findings in those three areas. And then lastly in our report, we also look at, we report on other issues, other reports that are not regulatory in nature. So for example, if there's an investigation ongoing at the department, we include that part of other reports. Or if there's a performance audit that was undertaken by management, we look at that. Or if there's any agreed or recorded kind of thing that was done or agreed on procedure that we requested to do, we look at that and report in our last paragraph. Maybe to just show the members what I'm trying to say is, if you look at for the Department of Labor, the last paragraph for last year's report, there's always other reports. Other reports is basically we highlighting investigation or if there is a performance audit. So like last year, we highlighted that there were some disciplinary hearings that were ongoing, but that report was not yet out at that point. So that's what I mean by other reports that we look. If there was any performance audit that was ongoing at Department of Labor, we would also include it in this particular paragraph. And then if you look at paragraph 33 to 36, these, we highlighting the internal controls. Like maybe these are the root causes that led to the findings on compliance and predetermined objectives. So we report on that as well. Okay. Page 11, I think, we talk about emphasis of matter and additional matter paragraph. But I think what I would like to maybe zone in and perhaps at this point in time, I'll just go back to the audit report itself. And perhaps we, for the member's interest, to look at compliances and explain compliances a little bit further to show you the exact kind of findings that we got on. And lastly, I'll conclude by looking at the predetermined objectives. Well, I'll start with the predetermined objective first, and then I'll conclude with compliance with laws and regulations. If you look on paragraph 9 of the audit report, it talks about report on other legal and regulatory requirements, and then below that, paragraph 10. Let me just read the sentence. I perform procedures to obtain evidence about usefulness and reliability of the information in the department's annual report, as set out in pages this of the annual report. So basically, for instance of the members, when you look at predetermined objectives, we look at two ways. We look at, normally there's an heading on usefulness, and then look at reliability. So there are two areas for predetermined objectives. If you look at, you read paragraph 11, we're evaluating the department to a particular entity on two areas, on usefulness and reliability of predetermined objectives. I'll further explain what we mean by spark of interest, what we mean by usefulness of information, and what we mean by reliability of information. Usefulness of information is basically here reporting on information that has been reported in the entity's strategic plan. Is it consistent with information that is reported in the annual report? So here we report, we make comparisons on what's in the strategic plan versus what's in the annual report. So if you say I'm going to do 200 inspections, your Department of Labor, you're saying I'm going to do 200 inspections, then in the annual report, we expect you to say, "This my target was to do 200 inspections." So we compare the strategic plan and your annual report. That's what we talk about, consistency. Then secondly, when we look at usefulness of information, we look at the targets and indicators that have been captured in the strategic plan and the annual report, whether it's measurable. When we talk about measurability of indicators and targets, here we refer to the SMART principles. So we want to know, are the indicators in the strategic plan, well-defined? Are they verifiable? Are they specific? Are they measurable and time-bound? So when we're doing that assessment, all of that, we call it usefulness of predetermined objectives. And then, once we're done with that assessment, then we come up with the findings on that. So if you turn over to page, on the next page, on paragraph 12, we say the material findings that we found as a result of the usefulness, I'm on the report for labor. We highlighted the specific findings that came across as a result of us evaluating the targets and indicators, how measurable are they. So here, the first one we say, for that particular program, 25% of the targets were not specific. And what do we mean by not specific? That it did not clearly identify the nature of required performance. So 25% of that target was not specific. We also look at time-bound. Time-bound is saying, if you think to do, you're going to achieve a particular target, you need to set a time frame. You can't have an open-ended target or something. If you need to indicate, I'm going to achieve it by December, I'm going to achieve it by January or something like that. So in most of the instances that we come across, we find that some of the targets are not time-bound, they're open-ended. So you can't measure the level of performance. So that's what we mean by time-bound. So we report on that. And most of the findings on usefulness and reliability, we only report a threshold, things that if there's more than 20% of the of that particular target that are not meeting the usefulness criteria, they're not specific, you can't measure them, they're not time-bound, or you can't verify them, then that's what comes into our audit report. We also reported on performance indicators not well-defined. That's three of them for that particular program, they were not well-defined. So, excuse me. All these things, like I said, that's what we report under usefulness. But the next phase that we report on predetermined objective is reliability. When we talk about reliability, we're talking about they've reported something in the annual report, but we need to go and verify whether it exists, it's accurate, and it's complete. Everything is recorded. So here, when we talk about reliability, we're looking at factual figures or targets that they included in the annual report. So we need to go in the annual report, performance annual report, and say, if you say you created a database of all work seekers, then you say, okay, give us the ID numbers of all those work seekers of that database. So basically, reliability we're looking at, factual. Whatever you reported, it should be there. It should be addressed and it exists. So in most instances, the findings that come across in that particular area of reliability is they report something in the annual report, but there's no information to show that they've actually done this. They've performed or they've achieved that particular target. So those are the two particular areas on office time and objective.
Your choice must be able to talk to ours. But the loan are coming to visit us. When we visit your office, we'll make sure that ours complies and in line with what we do. Yes. Cindy, you can ask a question. Honorable Fundamental and Honorable Minister.
Chairperson, I would appreciate it if the presenter could just give us an indication of an objective that is not time bound. Because I was under the impression that the objectives, as in the strategic plan and so on, should all adhere to the SMART principle, of which I think the last one does say that, you know, there is a time aspect to that as well. If you could just expand on that, please.
Chair, through you, before Joshua gives an illustrative example, I think when you look at what we report currently, in the public sector is doing its best to address the usefulness. So to a large extent, this has been addressed. And one of the things that you will not often see is that the target is not time bound because they have become experts. Because that's an easy one. Because honestly, if you still have a target that is not time bound, that's just silly. Because it's one of those things that you would say is a silly qualification. Because why do you set a target if you don't have a timeline for it? So on that one, they really have mastered the art. There will be here and there. You do get those silly ones. Joshua would give an example, but they've addressed that extensively. The common problems are around measurability. Because, and what we have found is that while you look at a target and you, in terms of what is explained to you, you think it is measurable. When you go and test reliability of what they have reported, and then you find that the evidence that they produce does not marry the target, and then you realize that this target was not measurable in the first place because they're giving you evidence that is irrelevant to the target, and therefore it's not measurable. So that you still find. But they really have mastered the target. And I think for 2014, once again, National Treasury has issued some guidelines in terms of marrying the target to the evidence, because they need to define what evidence will be used to justify it. A portfolio of evidence for the target. So it will get better and better. Although those entities that we tested that claim to have used the guideline from National Treasury still have that problem. So I think it will be a number of years before we get into the habit of that.
Thanks, Mate. I think you just answered everything because I think the old reports, the ones that we reported on, specifically one example would be in the prior was they say we're going to carry out 300 inspections, but they don't tell you by when. There's no timeline or time restriction on that across the nation. So, but in the 12th, 13th, 14th month, I think they've done an exercise to eliminate all that. And if you see, say for example, on paragraph 14, the main reason why they got all these things is because they didn't understand the requirements of National Treasury's framework for managing of performance information. So but now I think after the technical unit at National Treasury having gone through training for the employees involved, they tried to realign all the targets and indicators to be smart or to be specific, measurable and time bound. So come next year you might not, these things might not be reoccurring because now there's a better understanding of how to set up these things in a strategic plan.
Sorry, Chair, through you again, if I can just add, I think with the specific one that Joshua has mentioned, what we have also found is that the inspection is not defined. So when you, they will record an achievement that they have done 500 inspections, so they have exceeded that target, so they overachieved. But then when you ask for evidence to support the inspections, you'll find that they knocked at the door, there was no one, and they treated as an inspection. But I think now, you know, this is what we found in 2012, and I think now with refining the evidence that is required, it now it will not help to assess and address. Because now the problem is that they will not go back because it's ticked. So they will not go back to the specific one to do a follow-up. So once they redefine it, that this is what an inspection is, and then produce the evidence that matches what the target requires, it will be much easier. And I think we will then get service delivery that is appropriate and required by the beneficiaries that we serve.
You did ask questions about some of the figures that were given, that we exceeded this by more than 37%. And somebody asked, aren't your target, isn't to put a target low, that's how you end up doing more than what? But at the same time, what are the implications in terms of finances? Because you say you're going to visit so many areas, there's a budget related to that. And then if you achieve more than what you thought you were going to achieve, and it does not affect the budget, you can see that there is something, there are some things not telling. Honorable Hannah, you hand also.
Chair, you asked exactly what I wanted to ask, because this performance target must be related to value for money. And that's what I was going to ask about. If these people have set a particular target, do you have an instrument to check whether the target set was adequate or it was under targeting so that you can be over your performance? The chair has just articulated, I was just repeating because he pointed at me at last.
Why some of these things skip our eye? It's because we get given information at the last minute, you know. It takes the department more than 3 months to compile this report, and they'll give us the report just 7 hours before the meeting. Mm-hmm. You'll get the report on Friday, or let's say Monday evening, and the meeting is on Tuesday morning, 10 o'clock. So there's no way that we will be able to go through all these papers, you know, and look at the figures and be able to pick, you know, that there is something wrong here and there. But I think we've been very lenient with the department. See? I remember last year there was a time when we wanted to send them pegging back home. See? You are not ready to present this thing. We are not ready to have a discussion with you because we just got this information in the morning, like 9 o'clock in the morning, and the meeting starts at 10. So obviously, a lot of things will go. You know, we will definitely miss a lot of things. But I think there must be a way that in the next engagement, I think we need to take this as an agreement, an in principle agreement. that if we did not have enough time to study the documents, we need to send these guys ready. And we're trying to be helpful that, you know, if you send them back, then it becomes what? A wasteful and fruitless expenditure. But because we have those in mind and we care more about the public fund, we'll say, okay, but let's listen. But in the process, a lot of wrong things get, you know, go through without us noticing them. Yeah. And are we going to save money at our own expense that we are not applying our minds to the documents presented to us? We will save money and make them look good, but people will look at it as. I think this time we need to put ourselves first. And all of us buy ourselves 12 boots and kick everywhere. Are there further comments from the members? Honorable well done. This is the beginning of the end.
Just maybe to mention to what you said, I think in fairness to ourselves as a committee and to the entities and the department, they could give us enough time to study the document. Standard practice, you know, 7 days before a meeting, we should have those documents to do justice to understanding them. So yes, absolutely right, and that's your responsibility. You say to them, 40 days, they've got to have them. If they don't have them, you send them packing. The other issue, the issue that I've raised previously, the last interaction we had, as I indicated in my previous life, I was an accountant. That's when we were called bookkeepers. So I understand, you know, the workings and stuff like that. But I made the point about auditors and auditing. It's a key to a successful business, if you want. So we used to take auditing very seriously, starting with the internal audit, and then of course the external auditors. I mean, we used to probably Shiva at that time. I find this a bit lacking in the public service. It's almost like, yeah, the audit, the AG team will come and they'll do their work and that's kind, and we'll hear and then we'll sit there and maybe get a rep and then we go on 5 years qualified audit. How do we change this? How do we instill in people the pride to know that, you know, you have to aspire for best, you know, clean audit after clean audit after clean audit. As you know, success begets success. If you fail, you continue failing. Thank you.
Can I request that JCS needs to deal with compliance rules and regulations? And then when I deal with the pillar of accountability, then I will deal with the honorable members' question and address it there. Because he also brought a very favorite topic, internal audit. So that's where I want to talk about internal audit. So can I just deal with it there?
We are company scored 2 weeks ago when they did the compensation, and they met with the internal audit of the compensation. Those people have lots of information where they advise management, and management decided to do exactly something totally different from what they say. And I then talked to Zolani to arrange a meeting that we need to have a meeting with the internal audit of the compensation. First to tell us what are the issues. Why are they not doing their work? Because some of the things that are picked by the AD should have been picked by them long before the audit process. And now ask if they do that, if they get copies of management letters, and they said, yes. Yeah. So I think we need to bring them here. And that in all our meetings, we need to ensure that even in the DOL, UI, and all our entities, when they come here, they should bring internal audit people. Because more as this event, they will have about 8 to 9 to 11 people. And all of them, they just sit here, not even say a word. but the people who we really need to talk to are not around. So that if we have the delegate and just let's bring internal audit people along everywhere whenever they are to meet with us, I think that will be very much helpful. That we may continue with the remaining part of the presentation.
I think I'll summarize with the compliance and just go one by one, starting from paragraph 22. Here, why we report it as non-compliance is because the financial statements submitted for audit on the 31st of May, we as auditors pick up lots and lots of material misstatements and then give management an opportunity to go and correct. So that means in terms of the PFMA, the financials that they give to us, they're not free of error. So that means we as the auditors, they wait for us to pick up the issues and then they go and correct. So which becomes also a tedious exercise. They're supposed, whatever they're supposed to give us, like the honorable member say that they have to do things right. First time around, give us the financial statements, we audit and then expert opinion, but you find that in most instances, we audit, you find a misstatement, then they go back and correct. You audit, correct. Audit, correct. So that's why we bring you that to an compliance in paragraph 22. So you might find that an entity has not gotten a qualification, but it's because of the auditor's effort of identifying those misstatements and then management going back and revising the financial statement, but not due to them having proper controls throughout the year to identify errors, to make sure that all accounts are closed up on a monthly basis, all reconciliations are done properly, and then when you present financials, everything is at risk and you don't have to have material misstatements. And then the other non-compliance that we normally report on relates to, and I think it's majority of the entities, is procurement and contract management. Here we assess the expenditure that relates to supply chain management, whether the contract has been the stipulations of the treasury regulation, plus the accompanying instruction notes and practice notes as well. So you might find that this is an example of one of the department things, but most of the things, goods and services were obtained without going through proper tender procedures, or goods and services were obtained without less than 500,000 without getting three quotations, or goods and services, you obtain goods and services from suppliers who did not declare the conflict of interest as required by legislation, or employees who work for you, they never declare that they've got other remunerative work outside the department. So all those instances, we report them as non-compliance. Together with procurement and contract management, we also do a compliance assessment of the human resource management to see that people are recruited in terms of the public service regulation. If the employees terminated, they also call the proper public service regulation stipulations. So with the department, we only identified one in the prior year. And then we also assess expenditure management. Here, basically, we look at two areas to say that payment to service providers or payment to suppliers is made within 30 days. I think that's the requirement of the payment, that they need to make sure that they pay within 30 days. So if you identify a particular payment that's made beyond 30 days, we report it as a non-compliance as well. We also report on the fact that most of the entities are disclosing irregular expenditure and profit and wasteful expenditure. We report to the extent that they're not complying with the PFMA because it requires them to have proper systems in place to identify, to prevent and detect fruitless and irregular expenditure. So if an entity has got fruitless and wasteful expenditure and the regular expenditure, we're going to report it as a non-compliance because they did not have proper systems in place to identify and prevent those irregular expenditure from occurring. We also report on asset management and revenue management as well. And if another aspect that we report on is internal audit, but here for the department, they never had any issue on internal audit. That's why we didn't report it as a non-compliant. Yeah, I think that's the end of my presentation. The internal control minister has already touched on, and perhaps will elaborate further when she's touching on the pyramid of accountability and the assurance model. Thanks very much. Maybe the only thing in conclusion is just to say that our report is purely a regularity audit, and a regularity audit, we just look, in the AG's instance, we look at the financial statements, we look at compliance with those and regulations, and we look at predetermined objective. And perhaps on the slides, we say that different types of audits that an auditor can do. But for us as AGSA, like now when we express an opinion on the financial statement or the report that we present to Parliament, we're basically looking at those three areas. But there's something that's called performance audit, and that's a different audit altogether. That one encompasses the three areas where you need to look at. The three is economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. So that one, they need to pick up a particular area when they say, for example, they're going to say, okay, we're going to look at the, say, for example, Department of Labor, the area of inspection. Then they evaluate, is it, when they're doing the particular inspection, is it economical? Is it, the way they do it, is it efficient? Or is it effective? So in that one, they don't have a timeline when to report. There's no legislative date when they have to report. So that's the difference between predetermined objective and performance audit. Predetermined objective is part of our normal regularity audit. Performance audit is outside our regularity audit. And then that up, audits that we can do, or what other auditors can do, is investigation, but that one is also not part of this one. Or together we can incorporate it as part of the regularity audit. And then lastly is the agreed on procedures. Agreed on procedures normally comes when, say for example, if you've got aid assistance or donor funding, so the, say for example, European Union is giving Department of Labor some donations, then hey, as part of that donation, they will say, please, I want the auditors to do agreed-on procedures. But you can do agreed-on procedures, but you don't express an opinion. So that's the difference between all those different three types of audits. Regarding audits, we have to express an opinion. The rest of them, you don't express an opinion. You just do the procedures and provide recommendations. Thanks very much, honorable members.
Members, do you have anything to ask before Ma'am comes in and give us her presentation?
Thank you. Chairwoman, I'm under the impression that the AG, due to a lack of capacity, also contract other private auditing firms as their agents to go and do some of this work. I am, however, concerned with the knowledge that I have of the training of audit clocks and even CAs about the lack of emphasis on public finance and municipal finance laws. It seems to me from the syllabus at the university that I know, very little attention is given to the South African legislation dealing with public entities. And therefore, I am concerned that the position may even be worse, perhaps, than what the statements reflect. On the other hand, I'm also concerned that some of those people go, for example, to a municipality for the first time in their life, and the next time they're with an insurance company, and that, you know, and that there's not a bit of consistency in terms of what they expect from the different municipalities when they go to them to visit them. Now, I know
today's is specifically about the Department of Labor, but can you tell us, has the Department of Labor been audited over the last 3 years by the AG's staff themselves, or have there also been some outside firms that have done some work for you? My second question relates to the you've spoken to the guidelines by Treasury. It seems to me this has become quite a big issue. In the past, the guidelines by Treasury has been seen as the Bible, the law. Now it seems to me as if there's a legal opinion saying that these guidelines are just what they say, they're just guidelines, and therefore they are not enforceable in terms of your regulations or your opinions. Can you just expand on that? Where do we stand currently with Treasury and their regulations that they issue in addition to what is already in the different acts? Thank you.
Before we go, do we have any other questions? Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Through you, with regard to the first question, I think as stipulated in the Constitution and in the Public Audit Act, the audit of all departments, and I think it's stipulated they are under Section 4.3, provincial departments, legislatures, all entities that receive funds from the provincial revenue fund and the national revenue fund must be audited by the Auditor General. So all of these audits that are audited by the Auditor General, including municipalities, if an audit is, for instance, contracted out to an audit firm, it will be under the supervision and guidance of a senior official within the Auditor General. The audit report will be signed off by the Auditor General. So, if, for instance, let's address the question that you asked specifically. The individuals that are auditing on behalf of the Auditor General have private sector experience and not public sector experience, and they are auditing an entity that is under my responsibility. It's Joshua's and my responsibility to make sure that we familiarize them with the requirements. We review the work that they have done. So we own that work so that when we issue a report and it's signed off as work of the Auditor General, we have reviewed it and we own it, and we can then respond to whatever things that they have raised. If they raise things that are irrelevant or they don't address things that we normally address, it is our responsibility to send them back and do the work that is relevant, because when they start the work, we need to brief them so they know exactly what is expected and what we hook up for. And oftentimes, we also contact in staff from the auditor to come and do work with our team. Then again, those people are under our direct supervision and control, and we do train them and develop them, because as part of the Auditor General's social responsibility, we have committed a certain percentage of work within the Auditor General to private audit firms to also contribute towards the enterprise development. So we take full responsibility of the work that they do when we are signing off the audit report, to ensure consistency as well. So we don't just leave them to do what they please. And with regard to the second question, Don has always been audited by the Auditor General. It has never been contracted out. If you look within the Dole portfolio, the Audit of Compensation Fund specifically was contracted out previously. I think for the past 2 years, we have been auditing it ourselves. Even though it was contracted out previously, we were signing off on the report, so we were actively involved in the audit of compensation funds. The audit of UIF, it also has been contracted out, but we are also actively involved because we sign off on the audit report of the UIF. So all of those entities that fall under the DOL portfolio, they are contracted out. We are actively involved because we sign off. We can't just sign off without proper reviews, proper interrogations that attend all the meetings that the teams have, that they have with the ODD as well. So we are actively involved in all of those audits.
I think we need to add to that.
Recycle training as well. Part of our methodology, say for example, beach salmon objective, because in the private practice they're not doing that. But SAICA, our office also presents to SAICA with regard to private partners and whoever is doing work for us, they come and we have seminars regarding our audit methodology, more so on compliance and beach salmon objectives, things that they don't specifically would have done if they were doing a private audit.
Chair, with regard to the treasury regulations, as far as I know, the treasury regulations are part of recent regulations. We haven't been privy to the legal opinion. I think I'll take this back to our legal unit within the EGSA. So I'm not in a position to comment at this point in time. But when we do come back to Parliament, I'm sure I'll have a response, but I will raise it within our internal structure. Can I then proceed? There's a couple documents in your pack, and I just want to talk to the colourful documents. perhaps if I can start with this visa one, to the visa slide. The business slide deals with the assurance model, and the assurance model addresses or talks about certain categories of institutions that are responsible to give assurance on the information of public entities or departments in the public sector. Now, the orange block, it talks about the fundamental foundation. And essentially what it is saying is that the fundamental foundation is the responsibility of management. Because the next block, which is the blue block, talks about management assurance. Management needs to make sure that the fundamental foundation is laid. And this fundamental foundation relates to recruitment of skilled and competent people and maintaining competency of these people. It talks to development and implementation of policies and procedures to ensure effective internal control. Because with developing the policies and procedures, management is saying, these are the minimum requirements that I require from every person in the organization to abide by. So these are the internal rules that govern how this department or how this entity should be run relating to different aspects, relating to finances, and finances would be asset management, expenditure management, and a whole lot. Relating to performance information, how we plan for performance information, how we monitor year, and how we report. Compliance rules and regulations, how we monitor, how we prevent non-compliance, and how we report on compliance rules and regulations. So these fundamentals, management must make sure that these fundamentals are in place. And policies and procedures can only be implemented and can only be effective if they are communicated to staff. And if staff is not aware of what is expected in their area, because we don't have policies and procedures, when a staff member has not done what they are supposed to be doing, you will not be able to discipline them or redirect them or train them because you haven't given them the foundation. So policies and procedures are the foundation, because if you communicate them to the employee and the employee doesn't comply, then you can say, I have communicated these policies, I've given them to you, you didn't comply, and therefore I discipline you based on that. And the other thing that we are saying is when you have recruited skilled and competent individuals in the organization, you also need to implement a performance management system so that you can then manage their performance accordingly, train them where they need training, and discipline them where they need discipline. And again, we are saying if you're recruiting competent people, you're implementing effective controls that are communicated, you have performance management system, and each person's performance agreement is aligned to the strategic plan of the department or the entity, because we are supporting the achievement of the strategic plan. The systems that you have will make sure that information that you report to different oversight committees, audit committees coming to Parliament is complete, accurate, and credible. And in terms of the parliamentary requirements, the assurance that is required there is high, which means that information that comes from management to Parliament must be very reliable. So the assurance there, management should be giving high assurance to Parliament that information given to them is complete, accurate, and credible. And other assurance givers, internal audit and external audit. And there as well, the assurance is quite high. So when we present to you an audit report, we are saying we have audited the financial and performance information presented to us. If it's a clean audit, and that reminds me, or we did deal with a clean outcome. If this is a clean audit, then we are saying you can place reliance in these financial statements. And the same applies to internal audit. Internal audit has the same responsibility. And that's why I was saying to Chair that internal audit is quite an interesting topic to me. And I agree with the Chairperson. Internal audit should be called to Parliament when the department submits their financial and performance information, because they need to give assurance that even though they haven't audited the information that is being presented, but they have audited the processes that information went through, and that those processes are or can produce reliable and credible information that is being tabled to Parliament, and that will then give Parliament a sense of whether reliance should then be placed on the information that has been tabled. And the pyramid, on the other hand, is not any different. The only thing that the pyramid, the difference is, okay, is that the pyramid of accountability talks about where accountability lies. And the bottom line, actually, the bottom bar of the pyramid, talks to the two blocks in the colorful part there, management and the fundamental foundation. In that, we are saying management responsibility here is it is management responsibility to make sure that they have skilled staff and their daily controls, and the skilled staff are able to make sure that daily checks and balances are done, and there are proper policies and procedures and all of those. I think what is Triangle is saying is if the bottom part is not effective, and this is management responsibility, this pyramid will collapse, because then all information that goes up for audit and presented here on a quarterly basis will not be reliable, because none of these things at the bottom exist. So the information that is then presented to the top part would not be what the paper that is on. So it's very, very critical that the bottom layer is solid. It's a solid foundation to make sure that this pyramid stands and stands very, very solidly. And once again, information that is presented here should be presented to the audit committee. And what we also recommend is that the committee must consider inviting the chair of the audit committee to Parliament as well, so that they also share their insights, because they also have insights within the financial performance information and compliance rules and regulations of the department. So they will be able to share that information. So it's very, very critical that we invite internal audit as well as the audit committee, because they would have reviewed this information. And again, why internal audit is so critical, they also look into the internal controls of the department, and they are required in terms of the federal regulations to add value to management in terms of making sure that there are improvements in internal controls in an organization. So it's very, very critical. If I can also go a few steps back, I just want to talk about the focus areas that we look into, or that we report on specifically in the AG, because as the AGSA, we identified that there are five areas where if these areas can be clean, we might end up with a clean audit outcome. And these five areas is supply chain management, it's procurement management, it's HR management, it's IT, it's LPO, performance information service delivery, and material adjustments to the financial statements. Now, Joshua mentioned that supply chain or procurement management is one of the transversal areas. It's high risk, generally the public sector, and it's an area where we have most findings, where there's non-compliance. So definitely that is a high risk area. You see irregular expenditure increasing instead of decreasing. So it's a high risk area. You find that again, in this area, in the public sector, in most cases, supporting documentation is lacking. And the question is, why would supporting documentation not be submitted for audit relating to supply chain when supply chain is such a high-risk area? So the question should be, what happened to the document? Are we just hiding it away to avoid finding from the auditor, or is the document genuinely missing, and if so, why is it missing? And HR, the reason why we focus on HR, as we would have seen from the pyramid of accountability and assurance model, recruitment of competent and skilled people and performance management is very, very critical to achievement of clean outcomes and also achievement of targets as set out in the strategic plan of the department and public entities. So, you know, HR is very, if you look at our root causes, mostly you'll find that we'll be saying that the entity did not achieve their targets because of vacancies. They did not achieve or they had material adjustments to the financial statements because of lack of skills in the finance unit. Or the targets are not useful because of lack of skills in the performance information unit. So HR is very, very critical because in most cases it is the root cause of most of the findings that we raise. IT is also very critical because if you look at the three transversal systems, that's Logis and PESEL, that is used across the department, if controls are not effective, from compensation fund, yeah, and that is very expensive. If these systems are, if controls within these systems are lacking, it might result in a number of things. It might result in errors. It opens up entities for fraud and departments. It opens up entities for fraud. So effective systems are very, very critical in producing complete, accurate, and reliable information. Performance information, once again, we're talking service delivery. So there's no way that cannot be very, very crucial. So I think it speaks for itself, because if you look at member constituencies, I'm sure we do have issues there. So service delivery is very, very critical, and we need to perfect service delivery. Because you do find instances where an entity would have an unqualified opinion, yet performance information is qualified or disclaimed. And remember, if we disclaim on performance information, it means we were not able to obtain sufficient audit evidence for us to audit performance information. Yet they are qualified when it comes to financial statements. Now, if we talk about service delivery, then we realize that it is important that we have the same system that we have for financial, for performance information as well. And again, where departments and entities are lacking on performance information, it's mainly on blaming as well. And if you reflect on the example that Joshua gave, it indicates that the amount of planning that goes into performance information leaves a lot to be desired. Normally, Chair was referring to an issue where they exceed that target and what the target implication is. If you look at that instance, they are required to report on material variance to their targets. And the reasons must be auditable. We should be able to audit. So if they have exceeded their targets, they need to indicate that these are the reasons why they exceeded. For instance, they might have budgeted at a much higher price, and they were able to procure the services or goods at a much lower price. Now, was that intentional? Did they bargain? Or did they just set targets that are much lower with a huge budget so that they can exceed, that's open for debate. And similarly, if they underperform, if they don't meet the target, then yet, because this one is common, you find that they underachieve, yet the budget is fully utilized. But again, they need to indicate, if they under budget, what happened? And I think the challenge again is that if they don't achieve for this financial year, you don't always see them carrying forward that service delivery to the following year. Now the question is, what happens to it? If they plan to perform inspections in a certain area and they didn't achieve that, and they set themselves new targets in the following year, what then happens to the areas that they were not able to visit? Did that just fall away, or what happens? And I think those are the kind of issues that will raise dissatisfaction in their communities in relation to service delivery. And material adjustments to the financial statement. Here we're saying material adjustments to the financial statement should be an exception and not a norm. And unfortunately, in the public sector, it's a norm than an exception. In that, the material adjustments are as a result of lack of internal control. To find an entity that has one or two material adjustments is very rare in the public sector. You find that, it's pages and pages of journals that they need to put through, which indicates that the financial statements that they submitted for audit meant nothing. They might as well have not prepared financial statements, because if you're going to go through that kind of effort as an auditor to get to credible and reliable financial information, what then is management doing throughout the year? That's my question. We often find ourselves in a situation where audit teams have to re-audit and re-audit and re-audit. Let me give you a scenario. The biggest challenge that we have is relating to commitment, whether it's in the department or in the public entity. That's a transversal problem that we have. We'll go in during the interim. We perform interim audits between November, and we finalize them around the end of February. So we raise findings relating to commitment that these are the findings, these are the areas of concern, the control weaknesses that you have. And as a result, you could not give us accurate figures for commitment. Go fix it. We will come during the final audit, which is between April and the end of July. Go fix it and make sure that when you submit financial statements at the end of May, say that 31 May, you have corrected the whole population, because what we selected was just a small sample from the commitment. So go fix. We come back during the final, after we have submitted the financial statements, and we audit that area again, and we still pick up errors. And then we say, again, I've selected a sample. Go back and make sure that you fix the whole population. Once you are done, we will come back and audit. Then we audit for the third time, and there's still errors, which means they did not go back and fix the population. And what we are seeing in terms of financial management, in terms of daily, weekly, monthly tax and balances, is that if you have these processes in place, they will make sure that each and every person in the department or entity knows and understands what they are doing, knows and understands the impact of what they are doing to the financial statements, the performance information report that will be tabled. So Joshua will know that he needs to hold his managers accountable in terms of making sure that if they say, I have done what I need to do for the day relating to commitments, they indeed have done it. And then Joshua reports to me that in terms of commitments, I am happy that the figures that we are reporting in the financial statements are complete and accurate, because we instituted control that made sure that everybody performs their daily checks and balances. The information that is reported is complete and accurate. Now, the problem is that in the public sector, those disciplines are not there. They are definitely not there. All this is done at year end when they compile the financial statements, and they are bound to, you know, things are bound to fall through the cracks because there's no discipline throughout the year. And they are only picked up through audits and intense audits. You find that after we've audited the component five times, only then we find that it's clean. And by the time that we've audited it five times, we've probably audited the whole population. You know. So it's not effective at all. And then again, in terms of accountability, so we are saying management should take accountability. They know what they did during the year. They know what they did not do. So if they are honest and say that we agree, we didn't do what we are supposed to be doing during the year, we don't want an expensive audit, you know, because that's what it results to. The audit becomes expensive because we re-audit over and over again. So these are the type of challenges that we are facing in the public sector. And it definitely is critical to make sure that there is accountability. The chair also mentioned the work that internal audit is doing. And if we look around, internal audit is legislated. All entities and departments must have internal audit. However, if you look at the internal controls that are reported in the internal control deficiencies reported in the audit report of departments and public entities, you realize that there's a lot of control deficiencies. Now, if we had internal audits in all the departments and all the public entities, is internal audit as effective as it should be? Should we not be focusing on effectiveness of internal audit? And I think that's what we need to do. And if we call internal audit to Parliament to come and account what they are doing and how they are benefiting management in terms of ensuring that the controls that they have implemented are effective, I'm sure that we will keep internal audit on their toes and make sure that management also responds to the findings that internal audit raises. Because you also find that while internal audit raises, as the chair has mentioned in the case of compensation funds, while internal audit raises a lot of findings, training and development management does not respond to these findings, does not implement corrective action to address internal audit findings, and they actually go on another challenge and then do whatever it is that they please to, which is not to the interest of the public. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Who's waiting a call from the president? Brothers and honorable, thanks. I just want to actually sort of underscore what was said. And the big issue really is consequences, not. And just to reflect on exactly what was said, the cornerstone at the bottom, the skills, the competencies, that's where we fought for. And one of the things that I found going through some of these things is that I can manage and lead people if I know a little bit of what I'm supposed to be doing. Many of the managers don't know what they're supposed to be doing, so they get sold off for whatever, and so it ends up re by those people. And those, for me, are the critical issues that we have to do.
My question relates to the audit committee. I've heard the suggestion that we also invite chairpersons of audit committees to come and also meet with us and also face our questions. My question is just, my impression is that the audit committee it exists of external people. And to what extent has got the chairperson of the audit committee teeth in terms of, can the audit committee take certain steps that will really, exonerate them so that they can say, but we have done our bit. We have taken the steps necessary to prevent what has today been, but the fault lies somewhere else. What is that relationship of the audit committee and especially their line function? Because I'm under the impression they're more of a staff function, they're more of an advisory body to management. I would appreciate just to get clarity on that. Thank you.
I guess there are a lot of things that we need to do and actually to learn as members in terms of how the system works and the role of all these different people and what value are they adding. And where can we hold these people accountable? And where possible, we've got to give some of them teeth, even though we do not necessarily have teeth. And so does the AG too, toothless. Even if you find in your audit adverse, and I don't know what will be worse than adverse, something really was where not even papers are submitted, people are not submitting nothing. They will just say, we can, no opinion. And that is all. And then hoping that somebody will do something with that information. And the other person, two things, because the AG's office is bigger than all of us when it comes to accountability. If they cannot do anything, it actually means nothing can be done, I think we should start looking at ways of either if we cannot have teeth ourselves, at least if somebody some teeth. There are lots of things that are so obvious, particularly with the compensation fund. But let me say it all generally. We have spent R2 billion on it's the truth. Yes, we have spent R2 billion on computers and we don't have anything to show for it. The only thing we have are computers that are always, crashing, what. Information cannot be captured timeously. Payments take 6 months or even more to do for people with injuries. That even leading to the worst forms. Actually, the injury is actually becoming worse, leading to amputation. Somebody has, a cut on the leg, but because the doctors are not prepared to take quieter cases. They will become so sick that it develops gangrene and all this, and next thing there's an amputation. You know, if we're in another country, there wouldn't be any compensation, because all people who lose their limbs will sue the state. And I think we must only be saying thanks to the literacy amongst those who are prone to injuries. And this is really unfair for a caring government. The government is supposed to be caring, but it's not. We are not really. We are doing less when it comes to helping those who cannot help themselves. And we are in this. Our matters are made worse by those who are supposed to help us to help people. There is something called a milk cow, and there's something called a milking cow, and the two are not the same. A milk cow, we all know what a milk cow is. But a milking cow is a cow with a tap on the other. So you put the milk in it and then later take out. That is what is called a milking cow. And the ICT in compensation in Indol has become that. My neck tells me that this is this thing, the information technology is used as a milking cow. Afford people any other thing that they want to do to defraud the government, and there is nothing that we can do about it. Because if your information is not secured, obviously anyone can come with a little piece of paper and claim something, and this is what is happening with the compensation. We have tried our level best, but I think we can even do better. In our dealings with the compensation fund last time, we said we need to give them questions in writing. But the members did not contribute those questions in writing to the compensation fund, which actually, in a way, says, oh, no, it's okay, but there's nothing we can do. Why even bother to ask questions? But I think in our little corner here, we can make a very major difference. This is of right of giving people written questions to answer so that we can have records. Because people tell us this year, the following year, you ask them the same question, and they give you a totally different answer. You know? But if our questions are in writing, particularly for these entities that are in trouble, like your compensation, we are able, you know, in a way to say, but this way you answered 2 years ago, and you are giving us a different answer, you know. So I think we too need to pull ourselves, honorable members. I know that it's not easy. I'm still waiting for it to happen somewhere, where the ministers, a committee, anyone in the committee standing up, because majority of us come from the ruling party, actually saying, no, we're not going to support this budget until this and this and that happens. It hasn't happened as yet. But I think the way things are going, we will end up doing that in this committee if we really want to be seen as people who are adding value to processes of change and taking care of those who, of the vulnerable, who are looking up to us, you know, to help them. We are constrained by those who are at the face of service delivery. They are not willing to help. I think we need to do something very drastic, including even refusing to support the budget of the compensation fund until there are meaningful changes in there. It's called radicalism. But I think some other time it has to happen if we are to really push that thing to happen. Are there comments from other members? And welcome from Zimbabwe.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just thinking aloud as you are talking about the radicalism of us and the budget and so on. And my mind goes back to what we spoke about in one of the committee meetings to say maybe putting the compensation fund under administration on a caretaker approach to fix the affairs of the compensation fund might be or a solution towards getting it out of the ICU and healthy and moving on, as there are many people that rely on the compensation fund for their compensation benefits on injuries or loss of life that have been incurred during a work. Thank you.
Just to say, sir, you recall that at the beginning of the year, actually,
Honorable Madam.
Thank you, sir. I did actually urge the minister to do exactly what the Honorable Makuzala Mashal is saying. The minister has come back to say, extreme measure, give us a few times, we have a turnaround strategy. And I get my head spinning like this because of the number of turnaround strategies that are never stopping. So, yeah, I'm watching that closely through the video. To see whether the turnaround strategy will work. If after 6 months it doesn't, we'll probably make the proposal again, just filling that little gap.
I think we have given the department enough time to twist and turn. I don't know whether we still need to check when they bring their report for this year. What the situation will be like when we get the other report from the department. If there is an improvement, then we can only even say that if we engage the internal audit. One of the things we suggested is that we need to have engagement with internal audit so that when we say this is not working, this is not on, that is not on, it will be formed by, you know, people who have the cold face of this of the problems in the department. So if we engage with them, then we can be able to make a determination at the end whether is there going to be changes. Do we need to make this radical intervention that we're talking about, including putting it under administration, or even if the committee refusing to pass the budget of the compensation fund. But I think the more we think about these things, the better. And they will know that we are thinking about them and they must do something about them. Honorable Hanari, your hand was up.
I'm just worried that we are now discussing women's compensation. I don't know whether it's appropriate to discuss it now instead of discussing what the Auditor General came to enlighten us on about how to monitor the compensation fund. I think the time will come when we are going to make a decision about the workmen compensation, and I hope we'll be speaking all the same language at that time. There won't be a party line on that day.
The line all the time, whenever we talk, we are going to turn the party line. We are not speaking. We are not trying to be very smart here. You know. We hear the ticket all the time, 24 hours. So it is not a mistake what I'm raising. And the reason why we're talking about the compensation is because it is the one within the department that is having teething problem. And you cannot have a 14-year-old child still having teething problem. Or a 20-year-old, then it becomes a problem. The child will need the... Yeah, we can find teething powders for a 14-year-old child. It's not on. Are there further comments before we can... I can see a question in your face, Honorable Van der Westhuizen. You look worried.
Chief person, what is clear is that And unfortunately, the AG cannot solve this. It's a systemic problem. Some 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, one of the entities came to us. There, the position of chief financial officer is currently vacant. They have had a number of acting chief financial officers over the last year and a half. The person that they are about to appoint is, in all probability, not a chartered accountant. This is an entity with a turnover of more than R1 billion every year. And the problem, I think, is skills. We do not attract the right people with the right skills into the public domain or into the public service. And why would I come and work for a public service, and this is probably something which we will have to direct to the Public Service Commission, if the computers that I'll be given to work with will be continually crashing, if the building in which I will be working is, you know, neglected due to the Department of Public Works being underfunded, if vacancies in my department will be, you know, I will be unable to fill with competent people, etc., etc. So it's a big problem for the management. There are good public servants, I believe, that want unqualified audits, that are working very hard at it, etc. But I think there are systemic issues just making it impossible. And if they get consultants to come and assist them to bridge those gaps, then get hammered by us for making use of excessive use of consultants. So it's really, listening to these kinds of things, it does make me a bit despondent. And I do believe that there are work needed on many fronts. Because I do believe the private sector, they tell me that the public sector is now offering better salaries than the private sector. But why are people preferring to go and work in the private sector, where they will quite often have to work over weekends and all kinds of things? It's because of these other things. And when you retire in the public service, you can wait for more than a year for your pension to start paying out. So there are all these kinds of things that just make public service not as attractive, and now we need to compensate them with higher salaries. And as my colleague has said, ending in the public service is really no consequences for underperformance. So it's the environment we need to tackle, and I'm afraid it's not within the AG's ability, it's not within our ability, it's only if we can all work in that same direction that we will be able to resolve something as serious as that. But I'm really concerned about the skills of the people whose work you need to go and check. And that's why eventually you end up doing their work for them, it seems. Thank you.
We don't need legal advice today. There are no legal matters here, so our bush lawyer
is thinking about the public hearings now. with this, you would take you and to say the last words, and then we close.
Thank you, Chair. So it's absolutely true that there's a lot that needs to be done, and the challenge is definitely that there isn't any consequences in the public sector generally. And when you raise the issue of consequences, and I'm going to be very, very general again, indications are that in the public sector, in general, very general, indications are that people are recycled within the public sector. So somebody doesn't perform in one department and then you see them resurfacing in another. And this perpetuates this failure for clean old outcomes for service delivery, because it compromises service delivery as well. So it definitely is a concern. I was in a meeting with one of the ministers, and I said to him, "Minister, we can't continuously say that the root cause is vacancies Now, the question becomes, why are there continuous vacancies? Why can't they see vacancies? Is there some reluctance from the DG or the minister side to fill vacancies? And is it because they don't want service delivery? What is the problem? And I was really surprised. The minister said to me, I take full responsibility and accountability because I have not been holding my DG accountable to make sure that vacancies are filled. And I'm saying this, coming to the Honourable Member's question about the Audit Committee not having teeth. Audit Committee is part of the governance structure. And the governance structure is appointed for certain specific reasons. And in most cases, I agree, the Audit Committee says we do not hire, we do not have power to fire. So you cannot hold us accountable because we are saying Audit Committees, as the governance, as part of the governance structure, you are not effective because we are not seeing improvements. And they say the best that we can do is to elevate these things to the minister and reinforce what is coming out of the audit to the minister so that the minister can then start acting, because perhaps when the minister hears it only from the auditors, it doesn't carry much of a weight, but if it's heard from the auditors and the audit committee, it will carry some weight. And in such instances where the audit committee then elevates the challenges to the minister, we are saying they have done everything in their power, because like we saw, they don't have any teeth, and they're elevating. And I believe if they come to the portfolio to the portfolio committee and also share their observations with the portfolio committee, it will really carry some weight. And the fact that the audit committee members are here when the department presents, it will force them to make sure that they present exactly what has been presented in the audit committee. Because I'm not saying it is the case, but you might find that what has been presented to the audit committee is different to what the portfolio committee is being told. So you make sure that there's consistent information throughout. But from our side, Chairman, it was a pleasure to have this presentation to the Honourable Members. And if members need any help, we are there to assist. And I do agree that the departments need to submit way ahead of time so that the members can prepare, so that the researchers can also set some information and prepare the members accordingly, and be able to ask relevant questions and specific questions. And the critical thing is what we find is that when information is received late, members do ask relevant questions, but because there wasn't enough preparation, the follow-up questions are not as intense as those. And then it throws everything off, and then the department saying that they got away with murder. So follow-up questions are very, very critical. And the only way you can prepare for follow-up questions is when you've been given enough time to prepare. Thank you, Chair.
Josh, you feel represented. I just see you. Yeah, I'm happy with that. Thank you very much. Yeah, all the members, this meeting adjourned until we meet again. I just wanted to say some other things. Yeah, but I'll ask the members to remain.
Yeah, welcome, Honorable Knight. Will you help us to make a quorum to adopt the minutes? To deal with minutes of the past meeting.
Can we have a copy of the minutes? I have another meeting with the AG after this. You think we've seen the minutes now in the meeting? Thank you.
It's going to take us less than 10 minutes. Yeah, you can hang around. You don't have to go out.
Empty. Everything is in mind.